Warning, this podcast may contain graphic violence, sexual themes, and bad language. If our language offends you, we apologize, but we do not give a fuck. Be mindful of your kids listening.
The Evil Never Dies Podcast.
Hey, evil ones, it's Brett. Recently, I was a guest on the Tragedy of Cinema podcast, and we covered the movie The Planet of the Apes from 1968, and Jimbo was gracious enough to let me put it up on our feed, so enjoy, everybody.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. Today, we have a very special, special collaboration with the Evil Never Dies podcast. Joining us tonight, along with Kyle.
That's right.
We have the co-host or host with the most, Brett Stepanoff from the Evil Never Dies podcast. What's up, Brett?
What's going on, guys?
How you doing?
Great, oh, have
not
you.
Too bad.
Not too bad.
We're gonna be talking about some apes.
Some planet.
So I don't know, man. It's probably been about 2 months ago that Brett had one of his Zoom meetings set up after his podcast, and I joined in there and we started talking about some stuff, and then somehow Planet of the Apes came up, and I said, "Hey, Brett," I said, "why don't we do Planet of the Apes? You know, a little crossover with Evil Never Dies and the Tragedy of Cinema." And he's like, "Oh yeah, I like apes." Of course, Carl doesn't. So Carl, too bad you're not joining us, but yeah, what a loser. So we're actually going to cover the entire series, set, whatever you want to call it, of the Planet of the Apes movies. But this is only the first episode. This is the one that I started it all off, the Planet of the Apes. So I've given Kyle some direction on what he's doing tonight. I gave Brett some stuff that he's going to be covering. So
I got off by the hitch, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, it's gonna go perfect. And then I got some trivia and stuff. Then we got some Brett's got a personal story he's gonna share at the end about the original movie. So got a lot of good stuff planned. So Kyle, let's go ahead and kick this off, because there's a lot of information out there on the Planet of the Apes.
All right, well, I'll get right into it, Jimbo. Planet of the Apes, released on April 3rd, 1968, directed by Franklin J. Schaffner. Writers were Michael Wilson and Rod Sterling of Twilight Zone fame for the screenplay adaptation, and Pierre Boyle for the original novel, Planet of the Apes. Also wrote the Bridge Over River Kwai, another movie we covered here on the podcast. Cool stuff. Well, for the book anyways, that got adapted to the movie later. Some quick little technical details of the film. This movie is a runtime of 1 hour and 52 minutes. This is a color film. The aspect ratio is wide at 2.35:1. Budget of the film was $5.8 million, and gross worldwide was $32.6 million worldwide. Don't have inflation for you this week, guys, but I'll try and get it next time, okay? And country of origin, this was filmed in the United States, of course. International releases, it was also known as Planet der Affen. This is awesome. That's a cool little factoid right there.
You nailed it.
I did. Perfect. Perfectly said. I couldn't do better if I tried, because I didn't. Next up, let's move on here to the quick cast notes right here. We have the legendary Charlton Heston playing George Tyler, the astronaut.
You know, they never say his name during this movie. They never call him George. It's always just Taylor.
That's for Bright Eyes.
Yeah.
Bright Eyes. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, Charlton Heston, best known easily for this role, is Ben-Hur in the film Ben-Hur in 1959. Just a few years before this one.
I would have to disagree, because he was Moses in the Ten Commandments too, dude. That's a really big movie too.
Yeah. We haven't done the Ten Commandments yet. As far as I can say, the movie doesn't exist yet.
Kyle's probably never seen The Ten Commandments.
Also, easily best well known as Moses and the Ten Commandments in 1956. Then we have, he was also in The Omega Man as Neville in 1971. There's Charlton Heston for you, Jimbo.
Thank you.
Next up here, we have Roddy McDowall playing the character of Cornelius. Rodney McDowall was also in the film.
Roddy McDowall.
Like I said, without a hitch, guys, without a hitch. I promised you. We got
I'm just going to tell you, man, you're messing with some fans of the originals, man. You're going to do it right or you ain't going to do it. Tell him.
You're going to get corrected.
No problem. I'll take it. McDowall is also in the film Fright Night in 1985, Cleopatra in 1963, and Overboard in 1987.
And that is Roddy McDowall. Kyle.
McDowell. Then we have Kim Hunter playing the character of Zira. Zira was also in the films. Kim Hunter was also in the film. A Streetcar Named Desire in 1951, playing the character of Stella. And she was also in the preceding Planet of the Apes sequels in Beneath Planet of the Apes in 1970 and Escape from Planet of the Apes in 1971. So we'll get at those next show. Good time there. Then we have Morris Evans playing Dr. Zaius. I love that Simpsons parody.
Please don't.
What?
I said, please don't sing that.
I love it. Okay, fine. Maurice Evans was also in the films Rosemary's Baby in 1968, The Jerk in 1979. And he returned in the sequels of the movie. I think it was in the third movie he returned in, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, or there's a sequel, 1970 there. So other films he appeared in as well. Then we have James Whitmore playing President of the Assembly. James Whitmore was also in the films The Shawshank Redemption in 1994, Give 'Em Hell, Harry in 1975, Battleground in 1949, and The Asphalt Jungle in 1950. Next up, we have James Daly playing the character of Honoris. Oh, I believe he was actually playing a judge in that one scene he was in. But for the cast, he actually listed him as Honoris. And I don't think that actually was the name of his character. James Daly was also in the films The Young Stranger in 1957, The Big Bounce in 1969, and Eagle in a Cage in 1965. Then we have Linda Harrison playing the character of Nova, the lovely Nova. Linda Harrison was also in the films Cocoon in 1985. And she was in the remake of Planet of the Apes as Woman in a Cart in 2001. And she also returned in the sequel Beneath Planet of the Apes in 1970. Just love that cast note. We're going to bring you back for a little walk-on role. Like, oh, really? What am I playing? Woman in Cart. So classy.
Would that be a roll-on and not a walk-on?
Ba-doom. Oh! Next up, we have Robert Gunner playing the character of Landon. Robert Gunner was also in the films he was in the Green Hornet television series for one episode as detective. He was in the film The Jackals in 1967, and he was in the Frontier Circus Show for one episode playing the character of Harry. So his best known for actor roles go for on IMDb page. There we go. Tongue twisters right there. Not really a tongue twister. I'm just bad at pronouncing things. Next up, we have Lou Wagner playing the character of Lucius. Lou Wagner is also known for playing the character of Demon Sulik in the Star Trek Next Generation television series. He was in the film Airport in 1970, and he returned in the sequels for Planet of the Apes and Conquest of Planet of the Apes in 1972, playing the character of Busboy.
Was he pushing woman in cart?
Pushing woman in cart, exactly. Busboy pushing woman in cart. Yeah, it all ties together in the Planet of the Apes cinematic universe. Next up, we have Woodrow Parfey playing the character of Maximus. Very gallantry name here. Gallantry. And then, yeah, Maximus. Let's hear. Woodrow Parfait. Yeah, I'm going to own it. He was in the film Dr. Dirty Harry in 1971, The Outlaw Josie Wales in 1976, Papillion in 1973. And that's for a hit for the movies on there. I got a text message that could be important. I have to check that in a moment. Oh gosh. And next up, we have Jeff Burton playing the character of Dodge. Jeff Burton was also in the films Street Sisters in 1974, Coffee in 1973, and Get in 1965. Street Sisters and Coffee looks like some amazing blaxploitation films that I desperately need to check out sometime. But wow, those are some titles. He was also in the original Batman live action series with no, that was his name, the original Batman,
Adam West.
Adam West. He was in the Adam West Batman series for one episode, I think.
And what did he play? Who did he play?
Oh, I'd look it up again, real quick. You know, 1 second. This is my suspense music. Ezra, what was character we play in Batman?
Man in Window.
Man in Window. Real classy role. He played the character of Shamrock. Everyone's heard of Batman villain, Shamrock. There's one picture of him in on a giant green onesie. It looks good. Good for him. Good for you, Jeff Burton. You amazing man. Next up, we have Buck Cartelion playing the character of Julius. Buck was also in the shows and movies. He was in The Rock in 1996, playing the character of the Reverend. He was also in Cool Hand Luke in 1967, playing the character of Dynamite. And he returned in one of the sequels of Planet of the Apes for Conquest of the Planet of the Apes in 1972, playing the character of Frank. Good on him. Next up, we have Norman Burton playing the hunt leader you see in the early film, the first ape you really see, Norman Burton. Norman Burton was also in the films Diamonds Are Forever in 1971, The Towering Inferno in 1974, and Bloodsport in 1988.
I love that movie.
Excellent movie. Bloodsport. I haven't seen it in forever. I gotta get back and watch that one. So many movies I gotta get back and watch. Too many. Next up, we have Wright King playing the character of Dr. Galen. Wright King was also in the productions of The Twilight Zone for two episodes of The Twilight Zone. He played character Hecate and character Paul Carson for two episodes. I'm guessing those obviously separate characters for Twilight Zone, obviously. He was also in an episode of the show McCloud in 1975. And he was also in the film A Streetcar Named Desire in 1951, playing a generic role of the character, a collector.
Next up. A collector, a woman in a car, and a busboy all walk into a bar.
All these actors had huge careers at this movie. I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. And then finally, we have Paul Lambert playing the character of the minister you see for, I believe, just like one or two scenes in the film. Paul Lambert was also in the films Spartacus in 1960, All of the President's Men in 1976. And he was also an episode of Twilight Zone in 1960, playing the character of the Doctor. All right. And that is the cast of Planet of the Apes. Moving on here, we'll kick it over back to you, and I think we're going to move on to the synopsis and the awards. Want to take it over from me?
That's Brett.
Oh, Brett. Sorry, Brett. I said you, didn't I? Brett.
Yeah, you said you. I was like, you forget Brett said right there, and he's doing half of your job tonight.
All right. We're going over the plot then.
You fall asleep.
Right. Well, no. Let's go over the awards first. Let's see.
Go over the awards first.
Is there a lot of awards? I'm sure it probably had a...
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few. All right. Academy Awards, United States. Winner John Chambers for his outstanding makeup achievement in the movie. And this is for the Academy Awards for 1969. And it was nominated for Best Costume Design, Morton Hack. Best Music Original Score for a Motion Picture, Not a Musical, Jerry Goldsmith. And then 2009, the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films was nominated for Best DVD Collection for the five original movies as a part of the 40th Anniversary Collection, which I think I got on DVD, actually.
Nice.
1996 Genesis Awards. It won Feature Film for Classic Films. Jules Verne Awards for 2008. Winner, Jules Verne Legendaire Award, Franklin J. Schaffner. The Laurel Awards from 1968. It was nominated for the Golden Laurel for Best Action Drama Movie. National Board of Review USA 1969. It won for the top 10 films. National Film Preservation Board, United States, 2001. Winner, National Film Registry. So it's actually in the National Film Registry. It'll be there forever and ever. Online Film and Television Association, 2020. Winner of the QFTA Film Hall of Fame for Best Motion Picture. And that's it for the
awards. Excellent. And for a quick synopsis of the film, what do you have?
Quick synopsis, four astronauts. They crash land on a planet 2,006 years after their original departure from Earth in 1972. And they crash land and travel through the desert wasteland until they find some human-like creatures, I guess you would call them. And they were mute and couldn't talk. Well, I guess that's what mute means, right? They can't talk.
Yeah, it makes sense. It tracks, yeah.
So then they get attacked by apes that are riding horses and shooting guns at them.
I thought that was the coolest thing, dude, when the apes are on the horses, dude, right?
Crazy. Like, love it. Nothing better than an ape riding a horse. It's great. Cinematic archery.
So after that, the main character, Taylor, played by Charlton Heston, the other guy and Dodge, the third astronaut. They both get, well, the Dodge gets killed.
During the hunt.
Yeah.
During the hunt. And Landon gets captured. Mm-hmm. And so does Taylor. And he also gets shot in the throat. So he loses his speech. But the Landon, they end up doing a lobotomy on him. And because he was talking, I guess, that's the gist you get from it.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Zayas, I think that's why he came into there and wanted to see how Charlton Heston or Taylor was doing. Because I think Landon had been talking, and he gave him that lobotomy. He's like, I can't let this out. You know what I mean? So he's like, let me see what this one knows.
Defender of the faith, all right.
So Taylor, he's actually befriended by two chimpanzee doctors, Dr. Zira and Dr. Cornelius. And they end up helping him escape from the ape city to try to find a better place to go where the apes won't go, which is called the
Forbidden Zone.
The Forbidden Zone.
Yeah. Very convenient. Go somewhere else where apes would never go. Oh,
you mean I don't know. Zone? I don't know that the apes wouldn't go there. I think they've been forbidden to go there, and probably by Dr. Zayas because of the archaeological dig that Cornelius had done. Because there's stuff out there that he doesn't want the other apes to know.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah,
I think the Forbidden Zone. You know, they've got those X's up all along the cliffs and all that. I think, you know, it says, hey, don't go past this point, because he knows there's stuff out there that would basically
destroy their
a lot of the stuff that he's been telling them is probably a lie. You know what I mean? Like, we were here first. You know what I mean?
The stuff that they would find would prove that humans were there before the apes.
Right.
So then Taylor and Nova are riding off on a horse down the beach, and they come up to a destroyed, what is it? The
Statue of Liberty.
Statue of Liberty, stuck in the sand. And that's when Taylor realizes that
there was we made it back.
He'd made it back.
Back on Earth.
He was back on Earth, and that there's probably more than likely a nuclear war that happened.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question. You said four astronauts. We did have Stewart, the lady,
yeah,
at the beginning.
She was dead when the crash happened.
Right. So I remember him saying, why did they say that she didn't lock it all the way or shut it all the way? Is that why the
race kind of early?
Well, the glass is broken on it. The glass on the cover was broke.
But so was it broke before he laid down?
No, something must have happened while they were in flight, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it ever really says. It's just, he just says the radiation must have got to her, and you know what I mean? And then they just, you know, they go to look at her, and she's like that old, basically, it is an 83-year-old lady playing that part of the mummy or whatever, and when she comes back up, so They said like she's like the first 80-something-year-old astronaut in space or something in movies or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah. All right. So you ready to start talking about some fun trivia, Brett? And you guys jump in anytime you want. If you got questions, comments, we can go from there. So
fantastic. All right.
There's a lot of this stuff, so
I'm sure.
So basically during the breaks in the filming, the actors of the different ape species, because you had chimpanzees, you had orangutans, and you had, what's the other one? Gorillas. They would sit together in groups. They didn't tell them to, but they would sit together in groups and eat their lunch together.
It's fantastic.
It's like, wow.
Absolutely. Got to get in that gang mentality immediately. Gorillas stick together.
Allegedly, Jerry Goldsmith, who did the musical score, wore a gorilla mask while writing and conducting the score to get better in touch with the movie. He also used a ram's horn in the process. The result was the first completely atonal score in a Hollywood movie.
Huh.
When adjusted for inflation, the movie holds the world record for the highest makeup budget, then $345,542, which represented about 17% of the total budget of $2 million.
I bet the makeup was great in it.
Right, and if you get a chance to watch
it.
For that time era?
Oh, and it holds up incredibly well today.
Oh, it does.
It does.
It's amazing makeup work, really, truly.
And while I'm thinking about that, there's a several documentaries you can watch on Planet of the Apes that are really well, but there's one where Roddy McDowall actually has a home camera and he's sitting in the chair and you're watching him get the makeup up. And just, and that thing was 20 minutes long. I mean, Kyle watched it. It's kind of boring, but to see him, what all he had to go through, it's pretty amazing. And we'll get to some more of the stuff here later, but I have a question.
On every movie he made.
I know. And speaking of that, Brett, you probably remember this. I know Kyle won't because he probably wasn't born yet. But do you remember that TV show, Tales of the Gold Monkey, that he was in? About the about the airplane that would land in the water. I can't remember a lot about it, but I remember I used to love it when I was a kid. It had the one-eyed dog with the patch named Jack or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I vaguely remember that, yes.
But I have a question that I didn't see it in my notes, and I thought maybe you guys might know. The helper, I don't think he's their son, of Cornelius and Zira, was his name,
he was the nephew.
Yeah, what's his name?
Looking up right now.
Galen?
I believe it was. I think you're right. I know that was Dr. Galen was Wright King's character.
Yeah.
Like, further down deep in the cast, I'm gonna take a look real quick.
I thought it was with the L. It's not Landon, or is it something?
Lucius.
Lucius, I think.
Yeah, Lucius, Lou Wagner's character. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you notice that you could really notice it at the end, but he always walked with like a limp. Did they ever explain why, did he have something wrong with him physically in real life that made him limp around like that? Does anybody know?
I don't know, because a lot of them limped like that though.
Yeah. But his was like really,
really noticeable.
Yeah. If you go back and watch it, like, especially at the end when he's in charge of keeping off the monkeys from attacking the archaeological site, you could tell Robert because he's just like really dragging that foot and everything. I didn't know if maybe he got hurt or something, or I don't remember hearing about it in the movie. I just didn't know if you guys caught that.
I'm looking at his trivia right now. All it says here is that due to his short stature, he was an adult at the time of filming. What's your 1968? So yeah, he was 20 at the time of filming. So he's just a short man at 5'2". It's possibly had him on like stilts or something like that when he was walking to some degree. That could be it. But it said due to his short stature at 5'2", he often played characters much younger than his actual age, and that's why he plays the child character in this film specifically. So that's all I have on Lou Wagner.
So he's right there. The Kyle of the podcast.
I'm not that short.
No, I mean, young-wise.
Oh, no, young one. No, I'm not small.
Moving on. Charlton Heston was actually sick during much of this film with the flu. Rather than wait for him to get better, the producers felt that his hoarse voice added something to the character of Taylor. According to Heston's diary, which I might have to find a copy of that and read it, after filming the scene where Taylor and Nova are forcibly separated, he wrote that he was feeling really bad and while shooting because of his illness, and that it even started feeling worse when that hose hit him every single time, you know, the fire hose, like, because I'm sure them things hurt. I know because I remember when Rambo got it, he was crying too or whatever. So.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's kind of lucky that he had a character who only had, uses his voice for only half the film, really, or even like a, you know.
Well, not only that, but you know, you're watching that film, and he's running around there barefoot the entire movie. You know, I mean, there's the part where they got him in like
and in a loincloth.
Yeah, and they got him in that net, and they're dragging him. I was trying to see if there was like a metal plate or something he set on as they're scooting him on the floor. Because if not, dude, that looked like it hurt.
Dragging him on dirt, and sure, it sucked. Yeah.
John Chambers' outstanding makeup effects pioneered in the film were based on a technique he had used during World War II to give disfigured veterans a normal appearance. How awesome is that? Chambers spent many hours watching the apes at the Los Angeles Zoo, studying their facial expressions. Several other productions were delayed because many of Hollywood's top makeup artists were working on this film. Leftover makeup supplies were later used on Michael Conrad playing an ape-like alien in Fugitives in Space. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science gave Chambers an honorary award for makeup, which was not an Oscar category until 1981, for this achievement. And the second time that a makeup artist received an Academy Award was William Tuttle was the first for The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau, which my dad wants us to cover on the podcast, so I'm sure we will sometime. Chambers' award was presented by Walter Matthau and a chimpanzee in a tuxedo.
Nice.
What year was that?
Let's see here. I don't know whenever he won it. Let's see. I
probably think it was 69, probably.
Well, this is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science gave him the honorary award for makeup for this achievement, but it didn't become an official thing till 1981. So it had to be between this movie came out in 81. So
yeah, it came out 68. So probably 69 or 70, probably.
You probably look it up. Kyle might put it on Facebook if we can find the chimpanzee and Walter Matthau on YouTube or something.
If I'll find it, I'll share it at time of release.
Yeah. The makeup artist team consisted of over 80 makeup artists, which is unbelievable.
That's not surprising at all, considering the amount of people he has to put makeup in. Just imagine how crazy that would have been if you're an actor in the 60s trying to get work. And it's like, oh, this movie's delayed because we can't have any makeup artists. They're too busy trying to make people look like apes. And you're like, what is going on in this place? They're trying to make everyone apes.
There were just so many extras that they had to do up and make up too.
Yeah, but I got it in my notes somewhere. A lot of those just got like a sack cloth over their head or something, so they didn't have to spend much time. I've got it in here somewhere. Yeah. One of the biggest stumbling blocks preventing 20th Century Fox from committing to the project was its fear over how the apes' faces would look on screen. Eventually, they coughed up $5,000 for a test scene to be shot with Charlton Heston playing alongside the made-up Edward G. Robinson as Dr. Zaius and James Brolin as a character called Mr. Cornelius. The studio was very excited about the results of this test, but still delayed greenlighting this film for a further 6 months away. It was only after Fantastic Voyage became a hit and showed the viability of science fiction as a genre that Planet of the Apes was given the go-ahead, but without Robinson, as he suffered from a weak heart and he didn't think he could endure the day-to-day rigors of performing in the ape makeup.
I understand that. It certainly had to be an ordeal when doing that makeup. I remember like Jim Carrey in The Grinch had to get like a CIA instructor to teach him how to endure torture just to get the makeup on him every single day and all that kind of stuff. And I bet the ape makeup wasn't that much better.
No, I think we'll get to it. The fourth astronaut, Stewart, was actually originally written as a man instead of a woman. In the original script, the female native humans were all bare-breasted. This idea was quashed and squashed by Fox to appease censors. Oh, here you go. This is a really cool fact that I like. 2 9-foot statues of the lawgiver were made. The original used in the first, second, and fifth films ended up in Arthur P. Jacobs' backyard as the sole prop he kept from the movie. The other was given to none other than Sammy Davis Jr. by Jacobs and was kept by him for many, many years. Jacobs kept the original lawgiver statue in his backyard until his early and untimely death in 1973 at only the age of 51. His widow, Natalie Trundy Jacobs, kept the statue in her backyard even as she moved residences. Several movie stars and celebrities can be found in photo archives standing next to the lawgiver statue, including Charlton Heston, Edward G. Robinson, Kim Hunter, Andy Warhol, and a pregnant Natalie Wood. Huh. In December of 1998, Natalie Trundy Jacobs sold the original lawgiver statue through an online auction hosted by The Time Machine, a web-based memorabilia retailer dealing in photos and celebrity autographs. The winning bidder was an avid Planet of the Apes collector, Ed Gogan of Orange County, California, who outbid 20th Century Fox which won a lawgiver statue for its archives and marketing purposes. He outbid a studio, dude.
That means you're serious. You're serious.
That's crazy.
In December of 2010, Gauguin was featured in Joe's Judgment Day with his other apes and memorabilia. The copy of the Sammy Davis lawgiver statue was sold at his IRS estate auction for the singer's unpaid back taxes to a Hollywood actor and friend of Roddy McDowell. This lawgiver statue was featured in the 1998 AMC documentary Behind the Planet of the Apes as part of AMC's 30-year anniversary campaign, Apes Goes Classic. I just couldn't get over the fact that the guy outbid 20th Century Fox. Now, it could be the other way around with 20th Century Fox. Like, look, we ain't paying that much for it anyway. So yeah. They could have went cheap, you know what I mean? And he was just like, well, I'm going to take it. Because they probably thought they could get it and, you know, give it back to us.
Or yeah. They had a budget that they had to stick by.
Yeah, a budget. there are no female gorillas or orangutans in this film. The only ones you see are, I believe it's the lady walking or the chimpanzees, females. The spaceship the astronauts crash land in was reused in the Illustrated Man, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and the short-lived TV series Planet of the Apes. Brett, did you ever watch the TV series?
Yes, I did.
I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I ever saw it. Was it good?
It was 74 and 75, I think, when it came out. I think there was only two seasons of it.
Was it good?
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
They still have all the same makeup and all that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Man, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm going to have to try to find those.
Yeah.
The water pool where the astronauts enjoy a swim was built on the Fox Ranch by producer Arthur P. Jacobs for his adaptation of Dr. Doolittle. And to me, this is one of the funniest parts of the movie, too. The see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil gag. If you remember when he's on trial, one ape's going like this, one ape's covering his eyes. Yeah. I caught that right away. It was entirely ad-libbed on the set the day of shooting. It was kept in because people found it amusing when the film was starting to get way too serious in nature. The apes don't make their first appearance until 30 minutes into the film. So if you want to see Taylor and the other astronauts walking around the planet, which it's kind of funny if you think about it, because I believe it's Landon. Because Heston's always riding him about stuff, you know what I mean? But there's that part where he looks back and he's actually planted the American flag on the little soil he built, where they're already in America or they're still in, you know, Earth. I thought that was funny. It's a pretty cool foretelling of the events that are about to happen. All the ape actors and extras were required to wear their mask even during breaks and in between shots because it took so much time to make them up. Because of this, Mills were liquefied and drunk through straws.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and they showed them all. They had a lot of them smoked cigarettes, and they had them cigarette holder
thing. Yeah, the holder thing. Exactly. As a matter of fact, if you
like their hair on fire. Yeah.
If you watch that Roddy McDowell footage, it shows Dr. Zaius with one of them. He's smoking. He looks at the camera and blows it. Roddy McDowell, an experienced actor, recommended to his companions in makeup that they should frequently add ticks, blinks, and assorted facial gestures to add a sense of realism and keep the makeup from appearing mask-like. McDowell reportedly became a merry prankster with the makeup, driving home with his makeup on and shocking some of the other drivers on the freeway. While doing the Planet of the Apes television series, Roddy surprised none other than Carol Burnett when he showed up on the family slash bus stop slash brief encounter in full gallon makeup while she was taping her intro talking to the audience.
Fantastic. Good work, all.
Brett, let's see if Brett knows. Brett, what is this movie's most famous line? And it was voted number 66 movie quote in 2005 by the American Film Institute out of 100.
Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
I knew he would know. and you know, he says that, man, and all the Buckeyes are like,
what?
The rifles used by the apes were visually modified American M1 semi-automatic carbines in 30 caliber, primarily used during World War II. The M1s used in the film were housed in a wood case that disguised the barrel as well as the magazine.
Yeah, they were cool looking too.
Yeah, they were. Turning down the part of Zero was one of Ingrid Bergman's greatest regrets. Much surprised as how well the finished film turned out, she later confided to her daughter, Isabella Rossellini, that in hindsight, the film would have been an ideal opportunity for her to disregard her regal bearing. She also regretted missing the opportunity of working with Charlton Heston. This film contains Charlton Heston's first nude scene. Anybody wants to see other ones? I don't know any other ones he did, but
he showed his behind.
I'm always in pursuit of new Charles and Heston things. I mean,
his butt box.
And it's still got a PG-13 or whatever it was.
No, I think it got a G. It got a G rating.
G rating? Okay.
Yeah, this is one of only two or three G movies that had nudity. I'd say
This was before the PG-13 rating, because that was with Gremlins, I think, in 1982?
No, I believe it was Temple of Doom.
I thought it was Gremlins. Okay, let me take a look.
You're on it. Director Franklin J. Schaefer deliberately used odd, skewed angles and handheld cameras to create a disorienting effect, much like what Charlton Heston's character experienced in The Brave New World, which it did a really good job, man, because sometimes it would be upside down or, you know, especially when he's running through and the camera's like turning this way and that way. I was kind of getting sick. If you have motion sickness, it's terrible. Charlton Heston was always producer Arthur P. James' first choice to play the part of Taylor, but considered as a backup possibility was none other than Marlon Brando, which I don't know if I would have liked him in it.
Jimbo, it turns out we're both wrong. On August 10th, 1984, the action thriller Red Dawn, starring Patrick Swayze, opened in theaters as the first movie to be released with the PG-13 rating. But the reasons it was made was because of Steven Spielberg with the release of Gremlins and the Indiana Jones film was the reason. They needed a rating like this.
We're both kind of right.
The first implementation was the PG was Red Dawn. That's cool. All right.
There's something new every day.
Both wrong, both right.
So in order to make sure that the reporters would write about this film, producer Arthur P. Jacobs enlisted several journalists to play background apes. So, you know, what better way to gather excitement for your film? Than, hey, I'm in this film. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah, gets the writers excited for sure. Like, oh, yeah, you need to do this, 'cause I'm in it, obviously.
Did you know, Brett, that the spaceship inscribed with the acronym ANSA rather than NASA? The meaning of this inside joke is uncertain. The ship itself has been named by fans as the USS Icarus after Greek mythology's ill-fated flight pioneer, but later on in the notes I found where they actually came out and said what the name of the ship is. We'll get to it.
Did you know the ship was made out of cardboard? And they had a heck of a time when it was sinking. They had to hurry up and shoot before it sank out because it was sinking too fast.
Yeah. Filming lasted from May 22nd to early August 1967. Due to the stifling summer heat, all four sequels were wisely shot during the winter months. During the hunt scene, an unclothed Tony Epler, Charlton Heston's stunt double, had to run through poison oak undergrowth of Fox Trees Ranch.
Oh, no! That's the last place you want poison oak.
In there, done that.
What, running naked through California or poison oak?
That too, maybe.
We've all been there. It's a rite of passage.
There were three other endings suggested for the first film's climax, but this one was favored by Charlton Heston and actually ultimately won out for the final release of the movie. In the scene at the Ape City Natural History Museum, a large claw of a strange animal can be seen prominently displayed several times on a pedestal at the top of the stairs. Some have thought that this was the plaster cast made of the foot of the monster that attacks the spaceship in Forbidden Planet. Hmm. However, if you compare the two films, the sculptures are actually very different. So I didn't really pay that close attention.
Was it a monkey paw?
I don't know. It should have been. I don't know. Because hey, you know what? Do you think that when Zira cleans and Cornelius sits in and he says, hey, that monkey shines.
Knee slapper, Jimbo.
Thank you. The first director to spot the potential in Pierre Boulez's novel was Blake Edwards. He brought on board leading sci-fi writer Rod Serling, who produced nearly 40 drafts of the screenplay. While Serling was able to come to grips with the structure, he gave full credit to Michael G. Wilson for the final screenplay. Kim Hunter reportedly found the facial ape prosthetic so claustrophobic that she took a Valium each morning while being made up as Zira. After a while, she didn't think she needed the pills anymore and went one day without taking one. After the morning's makeup session, she thought she did fine, but her makeup artist threatened to find someone to replace him if she didn't start taking them again, as apparently he became exhausted from wrestling with her the whole time.
Oh, gosh.
It would take like 3 to 4 hours to put that stuff on them.
Well, some of them took 6 hours, like the chimpanzees. It's inherent.
Imagine like sitting there for 6 hours and you'd be like, okay, now we're gonna work the day. Actually, now yeah, work 8 hours after I make them on. Miserable day.
Well, sometimes they would get makeup, but they wouldn't even use them that day. You know what I mean? Like,
just because now they're done. It's already night.
Right. Ingrid, another thing about Ingrid Bergman regretting turning around the part of Zira, she would have loved to have done it because it would have given her the opportunity to act without relying on her beauty. So I thought, man, that would have been cool to see.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough to shoot for all concerned in the Arizona heat, not just for the actors in the ape makeup, but also for Charlton Heston, who spent most of the film half naked, being brutalized by the elements and the apes. As Heston noted in his autobiography, even rubber rocks hurt.
Yeah, and he was pretty sunburned throughout the whole thing, too.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm. He was sunburned. He had the flu. He was just not having a good time. Producer Arthur P. Jacobs bought the rights to the book, the novel, before it was even published. Some of the discordant musical sounds were created by using stainless steel kitchen mixing bowls.
Hmm. Impressive. Let's see. Creative.
Yep. So we already talked about that. Kim Hunter also, you know, the whole drinking through straws, smoking with the things. She found the whole experience so laborious that she eventually gave up eating when in full makeup. So she's like, I'm not even going to eat.
She's not even bothered. Yeah. Just a pain in the hassle. Jeez.
Pierre Boulez reportedly thought the novel was his own worst. The opening scene of the space rocket was actually the very last scene to be filmed because Heston has shaved off his beard towards the climax of the film. Remember, they're like, what'd you do to your hair? Your face? And he's like, on my planet, we shave. The heat in the desert scene at the opening of the film proved so intense that many of the cast and crew fainted, including the director, Franklin Schaefer. The producers considered Ursula Andress. Let's see if you guys think they could have played Nova. Ursula Andress, yes or no?
She would have been too hot.
Kyle's like, I don't even know who she is. Okay, what about this is probably Kyle don't know this. Raquel Welch. Brett. Too hot again, Brett?
Oh, not hot enough.
That's what they need to make it for. You know, it's hotter with the ape costume.
And here's somebody, I'm not even sure who this is, but Angelique Pettyjohn. Do you know who that is?
Have no clue.
Me either. Andress and Welch were uninterested. Pettyjohn at audition even tried on costumes, but the role ultimately went to Linda Harrison, who was producer Richard D. Zenick's mistress at the time. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, everyone had him back then, I guess.
Yeah, but they had to make sure they interviewed everybody. You know?
Yeah. Like, you have a role, but we have to do more work here.
At one of the first test screenings, a woman walked up to Charlton Heston and asked how he was doing. Heston had no clue who she was until she revealed that she was Kim Hunter, Zira. He did not recognize her because he had not previously seen her without ape makeup on.
That's amazing. That's funny.
He's like, who are you? Oh, I just co-starred with you in this movie. Oh, here you go. Rock Hudson was considered for the role of Cornelius. It was eventually decided that he was too big a star and that Charlton Heston might be overshadowed. It was also decided that the chimpanzees and orangutans should all be played by short actors. Julie Harris was offered the role of Zira. While she liked the concept, she didn't think she could work with the makeup and turned it down. Oh, here you go. Here's some people that we're going to, in consideration for Dr. Zaius. Yul Brynner?
Maybe.
I can see it.
I could see it.
But what, he was kind of tall, wasn't he?
Not really, no, I don't think so.
Well, I think that particularly worked for Dr. Zaius being the tallest one of them all.
What about Jose Ferrer? I'm not sure who that is.
No idea who that is.
There you go. Ferrer. Yeah.
Nah.
Alec Guinness. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Maybe.
He was a great actor back in the day.
He was.
Edmund O'Brien.
I don't know who that is.
Laurence Olivier.
Nah.
Peter Ustinov. And Orson Welles.
Oh, Orson Welles.
Maybe, yeah. I can see that.
I can see that. Yeah, totally.
And Jonathan Harris turned down the role of Dr. Maximus. Rod Serling admitted that he spent well over a year and 30 or 40 drafts trying to translate the novel to the screen. A year. Man.
Yeah, he was a writer, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
He wrote all kinds.
A lot of them, Twilight Zones and everything, created all that he did, night galleries and all that stuff, dude.
Yep. He was a busy
kid. I would have loved to have met him, dude. I think he would have been a cool dude to meet. The space
that book sometime is that the actual book itself is probably like a lot longer, more dense. Like, I'm sure it was a tough book to adapt to a film, for sure.
Probably just a comic book. It's probably a comic book with, hey, we crashed. Hey, here's Abe. Hey, we saved.
Oh, Abe. Statue of Liberty. Sure.
Like my version of the plot.
Quick and to the point. The spacecraft on screen is never actually named in the film, but for the 40th anniversary release, which I do believe that Brett said he has, of the Blu-ray edition of the film, and the short film created for the release called A Public Service Announcement from ANSA, the ship is called Liberty One. The ship had originally been called Immigrant One in an early draft of the script, and then called Air Force One in a test set of Topps collectible cards, and even dubbed Icarus by a fan who caught on to some caught on some fan sites. So Liberty One is actually the name of the ship. It's one of only two G-rated movies to feature nudity, the other being The Bible in the Beginning. George Taylor attended Jefferson Public School in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Kyle, he's a Hoosier.
He's a Hoosier.
The Icarus
where
was launched
is this
from
fort.
Huh?
When Dr. Zayas is questioning, he's like, where is this fort?
Yeah, he's like,
who is
this
Wayne?
A fort? The Icarus was launched from Cape Kennedy in Florida on January 15, 1972. And you know, Brett, that's kind of funny because I wonder if they had any confrontations. Maybe Zayas remembers confrontations from long ago. You know what I mean? Well, that's why he thought the fort meant like a secure stronghold or something. Maybe. Although he is second billed, Roddy McDowall, who plays Cornelius, does not appear until 43 minutes into the film.
Wow.
And yeah, I got
yeah, like halfway point.
And I got to put this in here, dude. You know what the first word spoken by the monkeys is?
What is the first word spoken by the monkeys, Jimbo? Tell me.
Ain't it where he says smile or cheese or whatever? The monkey takes the picture of the guys.
Oh, yeah.
Funny because they got the humans there and they're standing there posing with it. Like you see a lot of them old black and white pictures of the hunters. I thought it was funny. I just cracked up. Roddy McDowall, Cornelius, previously played Sam Conrad and People Are Alike All Over, which, like the initial drafts of this film, was written by Rod Serling. Conrad is an astronaut who crashes on Mars and is taken in by some human-like aliens to what appears to be a resort, but really is a zoo for humans. And there is a Twilight Zone episode just like that. Matter of fact, that is the Twilight Zone episode. Okay. I think we covered that in season one, yeah. This was released the day before the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. During the crash sequence at the beginning, the two very recognizable sound effects are heard. Do you know what they are? Either way.
The what now? What was that?
What are the sound of the two sound effects as the it's being as the rocket is crashing at the beginning? Do you know what the two sound effects are that you hear?
Oh, I can't remember now. I used to know this. I can't.
What the first is the rocket-like sound of the Batmobile starting up from the television series Batman. The second is the roaring whine of the engines of the Jupiter 2 from the original television series Lost in Space.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I watched it again today, and that's pretty obviously when you watch it again. Planet of the Apes was one of several projects where Charlton Heston took a role originally offered to Burt Lancaster. Lancaster had been considered for Moses in the Ten Commandments and was the first actor to be offered the role of Ben-Hur, which he famously rejected because of his atheistic beliefs. As early as 1961, he was announced as Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy. It would be 4 years before it would be made without him, and 6 months before Khartoum went into production, Lancaster was still being touted to play as playing General Gordon. Brett already covered that in his awards. An uncredited Erlen Mary Botelho plays both Dr. Galen's assistant and Quintus's mother. She has one line as the former, yes, sir, and one as a letter, come on, Quintus. As such, she is the only woman other than Zira to have a speaking role in the film. She also supplied the screams of all the female apes who were frightened by Taylor's appearance when he's running around and he runs into someone.
The little initial escape scene. Cool.
Yeah. This is the only apes movie from the original series to feature an actor's name above the titles. So,
you know,
that's something that always bugged me. You know, we've been doing this podcast for almost 4 years now. And when an actor thinks that his name should be first or second, you know what I mean? As top
above
bill,
the title, yeah.
Yeah, or above the title. It just drives me crazy. But I guess John Carpenter did it with almost all of his movies, you know, like John Carpenter's the thing.
When a director does it, it's one thing. When an actor does it, like,
that's what I'm saying. It's totally
messed
up. It's like their egos or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's all ego play. Then when you're a director, that is kind of like, that is the Artur theory of like,
Well, there's sometimes they do that, and the person doesn't even show up in the movie till like it's almost over. You know what I mean? I'm like, main star. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's probably, like, you know, like, probably had it where he wanted it in his contract that way. You know?
Yeah.
Like if it's Mark Hamill's The Force Awakens, where he appears to that one last scene in the movie. Amazing he did that.
On the set, it became a regular event for actors and their makeups to be given a banana as part of their lunch. Kim Hunter grew rather tired of this prank in particular, which was the sort of an inside joke in the third movie, Escape from the Planet of the Apes. So I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get there. The space ship's splashdown was shot on the Colorado River at a site called Crossing of the Fathers. To work in the desolate location, the crew had to carry their equipment in by foot or mule a team.
And they helicoptered a lot of stuff in too.
Yeah, they had to helicopter the actors because when they were in their makeup, they didn't want a bunch of monkeys driving down the interstate in LA or whatever, so they actually flew them in. Here you go. Early attempts at the makeup took as long as 6 hours to apply at once, and once they was applied, it stiffened on the actors' faces so that it was impossible to move their features or expression or express emotion. Other materials were developed which allowed facial movement and allowed the actor's skin to breathe. On top of that, it only took 3 hours or so to apply, so they came a long way just in that movie.
Yeah.
This was absolutely the biggest sci-fi franchise in the 60s and 70s before Star Wars and a revived Star Trek took it over. You can see they even made some toys and stuff that were pretty cool.
I had them all.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I had a bunch of them for sure, yeah.
Yeah. They're awesome. You still have them?
No, I wish I did. They would be worth a lot of money.
Yeah, they would. The first words spoken by the apes are when they are taking a photograph of some of the primitive humans. The camera girl says smile. So there's the smile. In the book, all apes are pretty much considered social equals. However, the movie sorted them into castes, with the gorillas handling the grunt work and labor, the chimpanzees being the scientists and artists, and the orangutans, the whitest of the bunch, being the politicians.
Yeah, there's certainly some race commentary going on in this film.
Yeah. Not only did Roddy McDowell and Ken Hunter spend time at local zoo studying the behavior and mannerisms of apes, they practiced speaking through the ape makeup in front of the mirror. Eventually, they taught the rest of the cast the best way to articulate their facial expressions and using of the mask. The merchandising of this film featured about 300 licensed items, including toys, action figures, trading cards, jigsaw puzzles, stickers, coloring books, board games, and costumes.
Lunchboxes.
Did you say lunchbox?
I had one.
That was the good old days when it had the metal one, right? And then yep. the thermos in it, too?
Yep.
Yep.
Exactly, yep.
It was the biggest merchandising effort of all time, worth about $100 million.
Wow. Big money back in the day. Big money.
Big money.
Yeah, and then George Lucas came along and said, hold my beer.
Yeah, exactly.
The production was constantly trying to find ways to cut costs, particularly in the extensive makeup process. One option was to put the actors in makeup and then transport them to the set. However, they could not drive cars for fear people would be shocked seeing a chimpanzee driving on the freeway and crash. In the end, helicopters were used to transport the man-made actors to location. Kim Hunter requested that she be scheduled in makeup for no more than 4 days in a row because by the end of several days, the spirit glue used in the appliances burned her skin. She ended up sleeping with Vaseline on her face to avoid having a bright red rash each morning.
Jeez.
Tough okay, stuff. Story time for Jimbo real quick. I was in a play for school. I think I was in eighth grade. Yeah, eighth grade. And I was in Cinderella, and I was the king or whatever, you know, the ball guy had a bald cap on. And the guy that was playing, you know, the guy with a monocle, the taller guy that was always around the king or whatever. Well, he had a mustache and like a goatee thing, and it wouldn't stay on. So they were trying to double side tape it, but it kept falling off. You know what I mean? So we actually took rubber cement, rubber glue, on his face. And all I remember, man, is after the thing, he's in the bathroom and he's pulling it, dude. And there's like skin's coming off of his face. I was like, oh, dude. I was like, that's rough.
Torturous, torturous.
I know, man.
What we do for art.
But when inside the outdoor collective cage, Taylor writes the message, I can write in the dirt for Cornelius and Zira to see. Nova attempts to erase it as though she knew that showing his intelligence would get himself into trouble. This movie was so successful, it spawned an entire franchise, several sequels, and a few reboots decades later, and a live-action TV show, as well as a Saturday morning cartoon, which aired in consecutive seasons, 1974 and 1975-76. It also launched a series of action figures, which became the model and prototype for all the Star Wars merch a few years later in 77. Brett, did you watch the cartoon?
Yes, I did.
Brett is just a seasoned ape here.
back in the 70s, they used to have like a when the new season of cartoons would come up for that opening Saturday morning, they would have a preview the Friday night before.
Oh, man.
And it previewed on that, and I was like so stoked. I couldn't go to sleep.
Did they show the next episode the next day, or was it the same?
The first. They just showed like snippets of it like clips on the preview. Yeah. So, yeah, wow. That was cool.
The sets were inspired by the Flintstones' hometown of Bedrock. On one of the Blu-ray menu, Montage's images as well as some of the exterior packaging actually gives away the ending. It actually shows the Statue of Liberty on the front of the DVD cases at some point. The film's world television premiere broadcast occurred on CBS Friday night, September 14, 1973. This being the longest film in the series at 112 minutes resulted in a 2.5-hour premiere. This left approximately 15 minutes of extra time, which was rounded out with a special behind-the-scenes documentary following the movie showing the process of applying the ape makeup. Dr. Zaius frequently makes references to the lawgiver. In biblical and Hebrew teachings, Moses is often known as the lawgiver. Ironically, Charlton Heston, who plays Taylor in the movie, also played Moses in the Ten Commandments, as Kyle learned earlier on in this episode. Charlton Heston's Taylor transmits his final report on 3/23/26/73, according to the ship's chronograph. This is 3 years after the lawgiver's lecture in the fifth film. That's pretty cool.
Small world.
Yep. In his voice log, Taylor refers to the emotional impact of deep space as giving feelings of extreme loneliness. When Star Trek actor William Shatner went into space in 2021 on the brief Blue Origin flight, he expressed the same feelings. The final scene when Taylor coming across the Statue of Liberty was suggested by Rod Serling. According to the rumor, Pierre Boulez was greatly upset by this ending, but later warmed up to it, preferring this new ending over the very different ending he had written. The skeletal remains of the torch appears as set decoration in Junkyard in Space. I guess that was another movie. The filming location of the classic final scene has been erroneously thought to be Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, but in fact, it is in Malibu, California. For diehard fans who want to visit the true location, it is a secluded cove on the far eastern end of Westward Beach between Zuma Beach and Point Doom. Ignore the wide curving beach by the car park and climb over the rocks to the east until you get to the quiet, often deserted little beach surrounded by cliffs. The Statue of Liberty was an optical effect skillfully achieved with a matte painting blended into a still existing rock structure. When Cornelius and Zira are showing Taylor the map of the Forbidden Zone, you can see the coastlines on the map strongly resemble the current New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut shorelines. Once you take into consideration the 2,000 years of a post-nuclear apocalyptic world's dramatic landmass shift, although the Hudson and East Rivers are gone, you can clearly identify on the map Long Island, Long Island Sound, Lower New York Bay, Staten Island, and the Atlantic Ocean. I guess I really didn't pay that close attention to it because I just like, hey, look, they got a cool map.
They don't show it that long, really, to even notice that.
Well, and you wonder how they got that map to begin with. If it's really, did Cornelius go out and map it since he was in the Forbidden Zone, or
he must have, yeah,
in the archive? Some viewers claim that the windows of the Icarus, when viewed from inside at the beginning, resemble the eyes of the Statue of Liberty, and when the Icarus is half submerged and tilting upwards, its shape resembles one of the points of the Liberty's crown. That might be a little far fetched. I don't know. Pierre Boulez's original novel also featured a twist ending, although slightly different from the film. The spacecraft crew does, in fact, land on another planet some 350 light years from Earth. The main character, Ulysses, which is Taylor in this film, escapes from the ape authorities with Nova, and they return to Earth only to find that it has undergone the same evolution. This concept was also used in 2001 Tim Burton Apes film. It is therefore not that great a departure from the film to have set the story on Earth the whole time. The novel adds a further twist, however. Ulysses and Taylor's story has been told in a flashback after he and Nova fled Earth as well and left a message in a bottle floating through space to warn off anyone else who might stumble across either planet. The bottle is discovered by an old married couple named Jen and Phyllis, who are later revealed to be chimpanzees themselves. They dismiss this story, saying that no human could be intelligent enough to write it.
Okay.
Brett, have you read the book?
No, I have not.
No.
No, I tried to find it once, and it was really hard to find back in the day.
Yeah, it was might be out of print.
Might
A
be, yeah.
subplot for the final passages of the film about Nova being pregnant were shot but discarded. All right, here we go. Now, this has got some great actors who could have were considered for Taylor. So we'll start first. Sean Connery.
Taylor?
Yeah.
Nah.
You don't think so?
No.
His accent would get in the way at that point of his career.
Steve McQueen.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yep, that could
Well,
be good.
Paul Newman.
Possibly, yeah.
George Peppard.
No.
Come on, you can't you just see I love it when a plan comes together. Rod Taylor.
I don't even know who that is.
Burt Lancaster. James Garner.
Ooh, James
Maybe.
Garner do it, yeah.
Rock Hudson. He was a big star though.
Yeah, he was.
Cliff Robertson.
Don't know who that is.
Stuart Whitman.
Stuart Whitman.
And John Wayne.
John.
No,
I
I don't
say,
see. We've been a very good
listen
movie.
here, you chimpanzees.
Listen, here, you damn dirty ape.
Yeah, we can't you seem like at the end standing behind an American flag or something with a gun?
Yeah.
The special effects shot of the half-buried Statue of Liberty was achieved by seamlessly blending a matte painting with existing cliffs, which we talked about. The shot of looking down at Taylor was done from a 70-foot scaffold angled over a half-scale papier-mâché model of the statue.
Yeah, that's weird, ain't it?
Yeah, it
Looked
is.
good though.
The torch of the Statue of Liberty has its original flame in this film, which was replaced by a new one when the statue was renovated in 1986 for its centennial. I did not know it ever had been redone.
Yeah, it was closed down forever.
Yeah. Brett and Jimbo, I'm checking here actually, and it looks like the mass market paperback book is actually still available on Amazon Prime right now, just $7.99.
Really?
I'll send you guys a link to it in the group chat in here a little bit.
All right.
Okay.
The twist ending feature at the Statue of Liberty was introduced in Rod Serling's initial drafts. This development was based on I Shot an Arrow into the Air, which was also a Twilight Zone screenplay, based on by Madeline Champion, in which the astronaut Corey, who believes that he is on an asteroid, discovers telephone poles and the sign reading Reno 97 miles and realizes that he has been on Earth all along. The ship crash landed in the Nevada desert. Hey, we're on the last page of notes, fellas.
Awesome.
Landon's planning of the small American statue of the Forbidden Zone is ironic, as they already are in the former United States. Explaining the effects used to transform Dodge into taxidermy exhibit, makeup designer John Chambers joked, "We just didn't have the heart to send Jeff to a taxidermist." Instead, special contact lenses were made to cover Jeff Burton's eyes completely, giving a glazed appearance. A custom mouth piece, which fits inside his lips and cheeks and added to the stuffed illusion, and the translucent body makeup completed the effect. Between takes, the actor was overheard to comment, "I don't see how those stuffed animals can stand it."
Terrible.
Although some people have read latent racism into the story idea, aka Kyle, as we talked about earlier, this is also envelope pushing in some ways, that there were two people of color who were major, at least high profile characters in the cast. Linda Harrison is a person of color who played Nova, Taylor's mute girlfriend, and Jeff Burton was the African American player who played or African American actor who played Dodge, who was in Taylor's crew running with him away from the ace, but eventually gets killed in the hunt. The sound this sounds insignificant now that there were two people of color in the cast, but in 1968, it was a big deal in a huge studio, big budget movie. Also, it paved the way for the world of sci-fi to be much more integrated in the future.
Yeah, anyway, look at like the character of Dodge when he plays, he's a black man who became an astronaut. That alone in itself is a profound statement,
Right.
in that sense as well. So yeah. And I would say I'm not saying this movie is a racist. I wasn't saying that in the initial one, but I understand why people can read into that for sure. And I believe it's intentional to a degree as well, but not in like a specifically bad way, I don't think.
Apparently, Landon has spoken after being captured, resulting in his lobotomy, as we talked about earlier. And Dr. Zaidis repeatedly poking around the veterinarian's lab. Zero, something's bothering him. He's been prying around the lab for the last 2 days. It's his search for humans with similar traits leading to his instant suspicion of Taylor. The scene where Stewart's glass suspended animation compartment is cracked is much the same as in Rod Serling's The Rip Van Winkle Caper, which ironically we're getting ready to cover the next time we record, I do believe, where a rock has fallen on the compartment of, oh, here it says, where a rock has fallen on the compartment of the fourth criminal while suspended, resulting in a similar demise of Stewart. So I guess a rock fell on it? Or something fell on top of it?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. You can't really tell because you just, they see her and she's dead.
She's fine. Yeah. The scene where, the filmmakers heavily debated the fact that the apes speak modern English, which Taylor understands. This should have been a clue that they were actually on Earth. In the original script, the apes were meant to have their own dialect, which Taylor learns while mute. So the audience understands the language, which would be presented as English when he does. So that was my final fact. So we'll start with Brett. Brett, before you give us what you think of this movie, give us your little personal story about the original movies that you were going to tell.
Well, in 1973, after the last movie was released, they had a thing at the drive-in where they played all five movies. It was a Dusk to Dawn thing.
Oh, man.
And my mom took me, and I stayed up for every single movie until the next morning.
Oh, dude, I bet that was awesome.
Quite a trip.
How old were you?
Five or six.
You were probably mesmerized, like.
I was. I love the apes.
That's awesome, dude.
And then in 74, there was a car show in our town. You know how they used to have, like, Spider-Man come? Well, yeah. Cornelius came to the car show.
No.
Did you go? And I got a signed picture from him. And I still have it somewhere. I'll have to find it.
Was it actually Roddy McDowell?
No, it wasn't. It was just somebody. But it was the exact makeup.
Oh, dude.
Yeah,
you have to do that, and you can post it on our Facebook page.
I'll have to find it. My ex-wife might have it in her, all her pictures. But, I'm pretty sure I still have that.
So are you saying Planet of the Apes or the Apes is probably one of your favorite movies of all time?
Probably one of my favorite. Yeah, for sure.
Nice. All right, we'll start with Brett before Kyle gives us his millennial take. Brett, what do you think of the movie, although we probably already know?
I love this. I love all the, at least the first five, you know, the original ones. I'm a big fan of all of them. So
as you and Carl do, how many monkey paws would you give this one?
I'm going to give it 9 monkey paws.
9 out of 10? 9
monkey paws. Yeah.
Woo-hoo. Kyle?
Yeah, I think this movie's pretty excellent, worth to watch for any kind of like film historian or any kind of film buff. Like definitely, like I mean, it's probably around the 8 out of 10 range, like right in there, right, sits there solidly. I wouldn't want to give it a 7. I wouldn't want to give it a 9. I think 8 out of 10 or 4 out of 5, if you want to put it that way. And I think this movie is really interesting and surprisingly dense. And I can see why it got so many sequels. I can see why it appealed to children of all ages at the time, and why it became such a phenomenon it is. And I think the reboot's pretty excellent, too. I haven't gone back to the Mark Wahlberg and Larkin in a long time, but I certainly love the Andy Serkis trilogy they made. I think that's one of the best trilogies made in the past 20 years, honestly, and pretty great stuff there. And this film itself holds up surprisingly well in many respects, and there's a lot to dig into. You know, I mentioned the character of Dr. Zaius. I love Charlton Heston's character and everything else going on here. Like, there's... It's a cool movie. It really goes for it in a way that many films in the 60s just didn't. And so I really appreciate it overall. I think it was a pretty cool movie. You know,
just the makeup alone for me, you know, for
special effects. Yeah. Especially the special effects at the time is amazing work being done. And frankly, kind of stuff where it's like really hasn't been topped that much since in the past, you know, 50 years, you know, to a real degree as well. Cause like, you know, many films would, you know, strive to be as good as this movie did in terms of makeup artistry, you know, but it's such a huge challenge. So, incredible work by everyone involved in that whole production, you know, really great stuff. So, overall, I think this is a pretty excellent film. Jimbo, how do you feel about it?
Man, I'm with Brett, man. I'm going to have to give it at least a 9 out of 10. The only reason I don't give it a 10 is cause I didn't want to see Charlton Heston's buttocks, but, so I had to deduct a point for that, but the special effects alone, especially at that time, there was probably nothing like it. That's probably what mesmerized Brett so much, you know what I mean? I mean, yeah, you can go back to the Wizard of Oz and some of those other ones, but something that drew me into it was the story too, because I thought it was really cool how they took how we normally perceive like men like going through, let's say, the jungle and just capturing apes or capturing any animals and all that. But here you have the apes capturing the humans. So basically everything is just reversed.
Tables
it's almost
turn.
Like it's almost like a big Twilight Zone, you know what I mean, where everything is opposite.
Exactly.
You got you got animals with guns riding horses. You know what I mean? They're like, oh well, he's a human, he can't talk, you know what I mean? But yeah, how long, who's that lady that spent all that time with the apes that they communicate, you know, and they can actually communicate back and forth and all that? So I it had me from the beginning all the way to the end. I remember watching these when I was a kid. Now I don't remember if they were on VHS, DVD, regular TV, because we used to have like TV shows like Sunday afternoons for like three, like from noon to six, there would be three movies on. They used to show a couple of them back to back. I don't know which one it is, Brett, but I tried to tell Kyle earlier, there's one, and I think it's either Cornelius or Zira, I think, that gets shot on like a USS aircraft carrier or something, remember?
Yeah, that's the third one.
Yeah.
Third one, so, yeah. Okay, it's got to get crazy then technology-wise.
Oh, well, yeah, because some of them go back in the past. It like it gets interesting. I know it's probably... You may have never seen them all, but it's been a long time since I've actually sat and watched them all like we're doing and actually dive into it. But yeah, I love it, Brett. Thanks for coming on. I can't wait to do the rest of these movies. I'm not a big fan of the Mark Wahlberg one, which we can bash that one all we want when we get to it, Brett. I can't wait.
Yeah, I plan on it.
Yeah, he said he's planning on it. But maybe I'll have a newfound perspective on it once I watch all these other ones. We'll see. So, yeah, we're going to be releasing this sometime, I don't know, once a month or something, once we can actually figure a schedule. But the next one we will be covering is, I believe it is, the second movie, Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So we are going to simultaneously release this on our podcast site, player, whatever, feed, thank you. And Brett's going to release on the Evil Never Dies podcast, so... Thanks for all the Evil Never Dies listeners that may have tuned in, or maybe any of our fans that went over and listened to Brett and his. They do a really good job. I've learned some stuff, especially about the rock music industry, because they would just start talking. I'm like, guys, I don't even know who these people are. And you're talking about, well, this bass player left and this. I said, dude, I don't even know who they are. So you got, I told him, I said, you got to slow down. I said, but they're good people, man. They're good people. Actually, I did get to go meet Brett last year, WrestleMania weekend. I went down there. We had some barbecue, some good times. So it was a great time. Wish I had longer time to sit down there and spend with him. So we're talking about maybe doing something towards the end of this year with The Evil Never Dies. So stay tuned. There might be some breaking news one day, but that's still in the very, very early stages of, discussion.
You were talking too early about it.
Actually, it's just me and Brett talking. We haven't even brought Carl or Kyle in on it yet. I may have dropped a little hint at Kyle. So it's going to have all the stars aligned and everything for it to work, but I think it could be fun and memorable. So, Brett, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Just thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Can't wait to have you next time.
Yeah. Kyle?
I would say that's a wrap, but I have a little mute fouser on it where actually it won't give me the clapper, so I think you got to hit the clapper on this one. Otherwise,
I got it right here. I got it right here.
All right, Jimbo, you take it from me.
All right, well, I think this episode's coming to a close, and that's a wrap.
And cut. Awesome. Thank you, Jimbo.